From WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard, produced with the support of One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Aaron Thompson was named president of the Council on Post-Secondary Education in October following the retirement of Robert King. Thompson came to the council in 2009 from Eastern Kentucky University, where he held a variety of leadership positions, including associate vice president for academic affairs, university programs. He left the council briefly in 2016 to serve as interim president for Kentucky State University and returned to the council in the summer of 2017. Now he's in charge. Thanks for joining us, Aaron.
Thank you, Tom.
So how do you describe your role as CPE president?
Well, I would say I have several roles. One, I think, is a chief advocate for higher education. The other is, being able to talk a little bit with folk about how we can make higher education a better place to be. And what I mean by that is a place whereby that if people come to Kentucky or people that are in Kentucky would see higher education truly as their route to a lifelong success story.
Okay, we're going to dig into that in just a minute. First, though, you bring a whole lot to the table in this position, and that includes more than 30 publications to your name, numerous research and peer-reviewed presentations, a bevy of books, and we'll look at some of those titles in a moment. But first, your perspective as the first Kentucky native to lead the council since it was formed 21 years ago.
Yes. I mean, I think this position requires someone with the credentials that they need, obviously, to be in the role I described earlier. I mean, you need to have really an experience, if you will, of serving the citizens in whatever state you're in, especially in higher education, that you need to have experience, in my argument, in higher education in order to get to this position of president. But if you have that along with what I call the emotional intelligence of actually living the life of a person getting to that point in the state that they serve, then I think it gives you a much deeper understanding of the routes that folk have to go through, especially our low-income students, those students that we end up disenfranchising more in P-12 as well as higher ed, students of color and so on. And having that experience, I think, gives me a better understanding of how to be more competent, if you will, holistically in this job.
Well, speaking of students of color and being competent in that area, does it matter? I guess it does matter. And maybe you would expand on why, that you have the perspective of being African-American who grew up in a predominantly white, very rural Kentucky county.
Yes, been from Clay County, Kentucky. My father was an illiterate coal miner. Mother had an eighth grade education. And being African-American, born in the late 50s, going through the 60s, the civil rights movement, going through integration, if you will, going through the idea, if you will, that I had the opportunity in the 70s when they were first opening up institutions of higher learning, mainly white institutions of higher learning, to people like me, having the opportunity of coming from a very poor background, knowing that I could go to college, that I could afford to go to college.
And you're first generation, correct?
I'm first generation high school student, wow. High school graduate, as well as first generation college graduate. So that understanding tells me, the places where I can fall off the cliff. I mean, I understand all those places, having to work while I'm going to school. So all the things that we're dealing with now in today's time around affordability, access, student success, adult learners coming back who are having to work while they're going to school and so on. All of those elements by which we have to work on deeply in Kentucky, because we still have all those gaps we have to figure out how to deal with, I think is very much a part of the life I had.
You had been with the council for many years before assuming the leadership role, and you also have held a variety of leadership positions here at EKU. As you've been in a position to witness the challenges to higher education that have come along in Kentucky, what stands out in your mind as the most important challenges in recent times or that we're facing now?
Well, the obvious answer is the massive amount of state budget cuts. And since 2009, the idea that once upon a time we could have students go to college, as I did at EKU, paying $19 a credit hour, and now it's substantially more. The idea that the state had heavily invested in what we call the public good, that we've switched that around and put most of this now on the backs of our students in many ways and their families. The thing that sticks out the most, obviously, is that. But moreover, the idea that many students feel that higher education is still not for them for a variety of reasons. There's a perception in some cases that they can't afford to go, which I would argue they can, and I would love to talk about that in a little while. But the other thing, too, is that it maybe isn't as important as it should be. So in my argument, we need to work hard, and my job is to try to put value back in this value proposition of higher education, that it is important, that it has not only some great economic benefits, but it has civic benefits, it has health benefits, it has a variety of things that would help a student to be a what I call a workable citizen in the state.
I hear a couple of things in that answer that I want to unpack, if you will. And the first is the per credit rate. What is that today? It was $19 that you referred to some time ago. But.
Yeah, well, it depends on if you're at a community college or if you're at a four-year institution. I mean, they range anywhere between $350 to $450, $460 per credit hour along those lines. So the idea that I want to be clear about that. A lot of that money goes back in the student aid that the students get. Mm-hmm. So the idea that there is a discount, if you will, or there's a lot of campus-based financial aid to help students to be successful is one thing. But yet, the idea that in 2000 we were probably getting support around 65% of the state and from the state, and the rest was on the back of students and parents. But now it's kind of reversed. And obviously, there's been a whole lot of things that have changed in higher ed. Buildings are getting older. The economy has grown. Inflation has grown. All kinds of things that are different than when I was in college. I was three to a room in a very small room in a residence hall versus the kind of residence halls we have now.
That student loan debt is astronomical, is very widely known. A couple of questions about that. First, do you think just the general knowledge that it's so prevalent and so astronomical today is a discouraging factor in deciding whether to go to college? People hear that and they think, I don't want to bear that burden.
No, I do think to a degree that's the case. I also think to a degree we haven't been very transparent about what that means. And let me be clear on this. I mean, if you borrow money, and I think in Kentucky the average is somewhere around $27,000 total student debt for students. If you borrow money and you graduate and you get a credential that matters, that's an investment. When you borrow money and you don't get a credential, then that's, in my mind, somewhat criminal, right? We haven't done the justice that we needed to that student. So what we see, those that default, and what we see, the massive amount of student debt that happens, it becomes very problematic when people can't pay it off. Or if you borrow so much and do still get a job and it takes up too much of your income to pay off that debt, still problematic. But there is a difference between getting an undergraduate degree with student debt than getting a professional or a doctorate with student debt. So when you hear about the $200,000, $300,000 student debt, I would say you need to disaggregate and figure out what people borrow that money for. Very seldom is it an undergraduate education. So there's a perception that's what that means. So the average or the aggregate is all of those items put together. But it's still too high. That's not my argument, whether or not it is or isn't. I just think we have to do a better job of counseling, letting students know exactly what the debt is, what the return on investment for that debt is with the particular credential they're getting. And the idea that, please understand, if you borrow this, sooner or later you have to pay back that money. So although you don't have to do it immediately, it comes due. And so you need to be cognizant about that and get that degree, stay on track, so you can, in fact, use it as an investment versus, you know, some lead weight around your neck.
Besides the knowledge, which should be obvious and as a reason for going to college, another very important reason, a driving force these days, is, of course, to set yourself on a career path and prepare yourself for a career path. About 15 years ago, roughly 15 years ago, we began to have this laser focus in Kentucky on science, technology, engineering, and math. And it almost seems to have come at the expense of the humanities and liberal arts, which can be equally as important in running a company, critical thinking, that kind of thing. What are your thoughts about that?
Great question. I appreciate that. In fact, we do need to focus heavily on the STEM areas. We do need to focus heavily on aligning students with getting particular jobs that we're in need of. Many of these middle-skilled jobs we still have in Kentucky, 100,000 we need to fill. So I'm very, very much for that. However, it's not an either-or for me. It's a both-and. I mean, I'm a sociologist. I spent 10 years in business, thought I did okay because it taught me skills of how to manage people, how to communicate, how to problem solve. So my argument is that we need to put far more, even those what I consider liberal arts, employability, necessary, essential skills in our technical and our STEM areas, as we need to do and need to assist many of our liberal arts folks, maybe if they wanted to have a micro credential in computer coding, if they want to, especially when this new generation that's coming up, I think they would love that. So if we look at the numbers, those with those STEM degrees over the first 5-6 years, they make a lot more money in most cases than the humanities and other liberal arts. But if you look at 20 years, you'll see many of those liberal arts folks in leadership because there's a path. And then you'll see that gap on income closing and in many cases passing up those. So the idea that no matter what degree you get, we should set them up for a lifelong learning opportunity to set up a way that everybody sees themselves as an opportunity to play in this economic game that we have. So my argument will always be it's not a either or, it's a both and. And that's the way we need to be making the argument to all of our students.
You're listening to my conversation with Aaron Thompson. He's the new president of Kentucky's Council on Post-Secondary Education, and we'll have more in just a moment. Coming to you later in the hour, a look at an innovative way to support local shoe leather journalism while also offering big city papers an alternative to so-called parachute journalism.
There's always been this parachute journalism where editors from larger markets like New York, LA, San Francisco, and DC parachute in reporters to write about smaller communities and towns across the country. After the election in 2016, there was a big increase in that across the country, and people were not happy.
Sarah Baird, creator of ShoeLeather.us, joins us. And later in the hour, the editor of a community paper, Jonathan Green of the Richmond Register.
We have everything from birthday announcements and, you know, who won the local spelling bee to, you know, actual in-depth stories on what's happening in the county.
Plus, we'll hear what is lost when a community paper goes dark.
So here you had an ongoing federal investigation into the role a Colorado company allegedly played in endangering kids in a foreign nation, and my newspaper was shutting down.
It's all ahead in the hour. Back with more of our Aaron Thompson interview after the break. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the Alltech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of just one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through 21st, 2019, in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com. Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers John Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com.
We're We're back, and we have more of my conversation with Aaron Thompson. He's the new president of the Kentucky Council on Postsecondary Education. Let's turn to the health of the institutions themselves. Performance-based funding for higher education in Kentucky was approved by the legislature a year or so ago. The theory being that tying some funding for the state's public universities and community colleges to outcomes could incentivize these institutions to graduate more students. Is it too early right now to judge whether performance-based funding has been effective?
Well, I'm a data guy. So if you're looking for what I call an empirical or quantitative answer to that question, the answer is yes, it's way too early. We need time to let it run out and see. If you're looking for a more substantive qualitative answer is, yeah, we can see some more focus, if you will, in the building of the process on our campuses to focus on that. So, yes, I mean, the idea that the metrics in the performance-based funding, in my opinion, are very much the correct metrics. I mean, I would love to have a quality metric in there, and I would love to talk about that in a few minutes, too. But the idea that we do need more people with more credentials, that matters. We need more students of color and more low-income students participating at a more equitable level. That matters. We need students to finish faster than they used to. That matters. We need STEM. That matters. So all of those our campuses are focusing on heavily now. So substantively speaking, absolutely. But the argument is that we also need to put money in this performance-based model in order to really make it work. And when you've already been as strapped as many of our campuses have been over the last many years with budget cuts, the idea that to keep exchanging dollars that in many cases they don't have, and I would argue they are to the bone now. I mean, yes, there were, was fat. But after so many cuts, and now we are as lean and mean as you possibly can get, as an example with what happened at this institution a year or so ago with the kind of cuts that they had to make. So funding these efforts, funding these particular metrics, funding a way to really incentivize this performance-based funding model, I think, is what I will be arguing for heavily.
And you mentioned quality, and of course that's what we all seek and hope for in the institutions that we go to. How would that be measured?
You know, we're in the process of doing that now. I'm sitting on a couple of these national groups that Lumina and other folks are supporting to talk about that. And I'm not sure we'll come up with a complete answer to in the next little bit. But I think we are moving closely toward at least having some triangulated variables that allow us to think about that. For an example, if employers telling us that we're not, quote unquote, preparing students that they need to with the quality credential that they need. So one of the things we can do is get employers in on the front end to help build those particular programs and those degrees whereby they then are aligned with what they need to be built. And when they tell us this, it's really in most cases not about the technical skills. It's more of what we call those employability skills.
Soft skills.
So, yeah, I mean, and I think they're very hard in my mind, right?
We hear a lot about communication being an issue.
Absolutely, written and oral. Whether you're writing a technical document or you're writing, some sort of a more complete academic document, it's very much an issue in the written way. And being able to communicate with people of varying backgrounds matter. So the idea that if we can do more of that, that is a sign of quality, no doubt. If we can do more authentic understanding of whether or not students are really getting it versus using standardized ways of thinking about this, I think that leads to a deeper level of quality.
You've been doing a lot of communicating yourself. As I mentioned, you have a lot of publications to your credit, and you've co-authored the book Diversity and the College Experience. What do you tell students about understanding and appreciating diversity?
Oh, thank you for asking that question, because I think most people get into this conversation. I love to get into an audience and ask people, how many of you believe in diversity? And all hands will go up. And then I say, well, how many of you value diversity? All hands will go up. Then I say, how many of you can give me a definition of it? and that's when it goes, just stays where it's at. Mm-hmm. Point being is we're used to talking about this from, you know, a feel-good standpoint. Diversity has a real deep operational understanding within higher education. We even align what we do in our curriculum around a diverse curriculum. Somebody should have arts, you know, should have science, should have biological science, should have, and so on. It's the idea that the more holistic education you give a student, the more holistic that student is. So diversity is about becoming more whole. We live in a world that is full of people with different ideas, different backgrounds, different colors, different ethnicities, different ways of thinking and learning. So in a university setting or in a college setting, that's when you should be able to explore diversity at a deep learning level. So I tell students that the first year you go to college, you will experience diversity at far more of a grandiose level than you will any other time in your career, because in most cases they're coming from a fairly monolithic background. Then they get to a university and have all these kinds of folk there. So the universities are called upon, and that's what we're pushing here. We have a diversity policy, and even in our performance funding, saying it's more about allowing students to learn from people different from them, because that's where deep learning happens. So diversity is about deep learning. It's about creative output. So I talk to them about the standpoint of the practicality of diversity more than just this feel-good piece of it.
Another of your book titles, Changing Student Culture from the Ground Up. What's that about?
Students have all this creative ability, right? And how do we help them to learn from one another? This is about peer-to-peer leadership. It's about, I mean, I give the example, by the time a student gets to be 11 or 12 years old, they will learn more from their peers than they will from an adult in many cases. So how do we empower them to have the right kinds of leadership skills to help students get where they need to go? As my mama used to say, boy, you hang out with the no goods and you'll be no good. So this book is about empowering students to use their creativity, their leadership abilities, giving them the tools to help other students be successful. So it's about, instead of looking at students truly as an object, you know, looking at them as teaching them something, it's really setting up a learning paradigm, using students as an ability to learn from each other and learn from us as well as we learn from them. So that's what the book is all about.
What's on the council's short list of legislative priorities as the 2019 General Assembly cranks up?
There is a situation for many of our comprehensive universities that right now they pay about 47% or 49% of every dollar to the pension plan, to KERS. And that is supposed to raise to like 84% next year. I mean, that's a huge cut for many of our institutions that don't have that money. So one piece, we're going to be heavily arguing that until we figure out a solution to the pension crisis, let's figure out how to not charge the institutions that. I mean, we can't take another hit. We have declining enrollments. We have so many other, you know, buildings that are falling down around us. Seriously, I'm not joking. You've heard about the mold and stuff. I mean, the idea that if we are having to once again take up that amount of money, you know, and for some institutions, maybe $8, $9, $10 million that will immediately be taken out of the budget that they have to figure out how to replace to help our students. So that's the one thing. And, you know, the second thing is, you know, I'm going to be working with the institutions, already am, to talk about how can we look at ourselves to be a little more mission specific. And this gets more into the next year's budget cycle than it does this coming short session. But the idea, how can we focus and become what I call just big, nationally big in an area? You know, I mean, EKU has, you know, very much this aviation program as an example. I'm not necessarily trying to suggest to Mike Benson and his crew what they should be thinking about, but I look at that as a powerful opportunity for EKU because it's so unique. How do we take these sorts of items, get some money into the budget to help really for this to become something fairly large. Then they can take other dollars to spread around campus, you know, maybe for faculty raises and so on. So that's a part. Other part is to try to get, you know, money, obviously, to support performance funding. I mean, we have it now. They approved it. How do we support it, as an example? Deferred maintenance. I mean, we can't keep operating the state's buildings without a way to help these buildings to stay upright. And so those are some of the examples of what we will be arguing.
Aaron Thompson is president of the Kentucky Council on Postsecondary Education. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Here's how a recent article in the New York Times begins. In recent years, as local news organizations have been decimated by layoffs and industry consolidation, communities across the country have complained that journalists who come into their towns and cities too often produce shallow or misrepresentative reporting. Local journalists who know their hometowns could report the same stories more accurately and with more depth, they say. Sarah Baird, a journalist from Richmond, Kentucky, is among the critics, and she has an answer. And she is here with us to talk about that solution, a web-based platform called Shoe Leather. Thanks for joining us, Sarah.
Great to be here.
First, let's talk about the term that you choose for your site, Shoe Leather, which kind of brings to mind a certain kind of journalism. What's your thinking there?
Sure. Yeah. Shoe leather journalism is exactly what it sounds like. It's really pounding the pavement and using, you know, wearing the shoe leather off your shoes in terms of being on the ground and really getting that story through talking to people and being local and making those connections, as opposed to kind of armchair journalism, I guess, where you just, you know, make judgments from afar. Yeah.
Okay, let's begin at point A with shoe leather. What inspired you to develop this tool in the first place?
There's always been this, I guess another term is parachute journalism, where editors from larger markets like New York, LA, San Francisco, and DC parachute in reporters to write about smaller communities and towns across the country. After the election in 2016, there was a big increase in that across the country, and people were not happy, you know. And as a journalist who's always worked outside of these major markets, but who always had editors in these markets, and, you know, 90% of my editors have been in New York usually, I thought, you know, they would appreciate, and everyone on the ground obviously would love, a resource to connect these national editors who always say, well, we just don't know anyone on the ground. Mm-hmm. You know, we have no resource for that. A way to connect them with all these wonderful, smart, engaged local reporters who are in rural Kansas or West Texas or these places that you don't necessarily think of.
A good example of that might be the recent 6th District congressional race, which attracted a lot of national attention and a lot of parachute journalism. Reporters coming in here from New York and L.A. and Washington, D.C. to look at the Andy Barr, Amy McGrath face-off. So perhaps they could save a nickel and also take advantage of that local perspective by using one of your connections.
Sure, yeah. I mean, there are about, I think right now in the database, we have over 1,000 reporters so far. We're almost a month old, which is exciting, from all 50 states. There are about 42 in Kentucky, which is great. So, you know, any of those 42, but, you know, in particular, someone from the 6th District could definitely not only report on what's happening in that congressional race, but provide community context and economic context and social context and make it a story that's really well-rounded and fleshed out instead of just this kind of, you know, very pinpointed story that really just doesn't contribute much to the overall conversation.
And what's happened since this story appeared in the New York Times? How did that happen?
They just reached out. They were interested in writing about it. I do think it's something that on both sides of things, you know, local reporters and people from outside these major media hubs are tired of parachute journalism. It's exhausting. People are getting their communities wrong. And I do think editors have been looking for a resource to find those connections and make those connections to get the better stories on all fronts, whether you're writing a feature about, you know, foodways in a place or doing something that's more breaking news oriented. So it's been, yeah.
I was about to ask what you do to encourage larger news organizations to use shoe leather, but that New York Times piece probably went a long way toward doing that, I would say.
It did. It really did. It's been great. I've had, you know, reaching out to me just one-on-one. I've had about 35 editors from different national publications reach out, which has been really great so far. One thing that has been really great about Shoe Leather that, you know, is when you build a tool, finding ways that you didn't even think it would be used, you know, that people are using it. And one of those is that larger regional papers are actually using it to find people in smaller towns around instead of even parachuting reporters from these big cities like Houston or Atlanta into these smaller communities. So you're really seeing it work on a regional level as well, which is neat.
That's interesting. So Cincinnati, for example, instead of parachuting somebody into Richmond or Berea, they might reach out.
Sure, exactly.
And you've heard from editors. I'm curious about that. What kind of feedback are you getting? What are they telling you?
That one called it a godsend. I mean, it's very interesting because it really works to everyone's advantage, right? You're going, if you have a local reporting, a local story, you're going to get something that's more informed, better rounded, more in-depth. And, you know, on the editor side of things, you are actually going to save money by not, you know, sending in somebody who's not informed. And, you know, it really takes away the excuse on the side of the editor that they don't know anyone on the ground, you know? So that's a big piece of it as well.
There seems to be a lot more collaboration, kind of getting over the competitive issue in news media these days. In fact, we also have talked to Jonathan Green of the Richmond Register, and they're going to contribute content to Eastern Standard and to WEKU News, and we'll contribute to them. That kind of collaboration seems to be happening more often now. What are you seeing out there?
There's really a ton of that. I mean, you know, the media landscape changes, you know, almost on a weekly basis. And, you know, I think that as journalism becomes a little bit more spread out just naturally, you know, there aren't those sort of publications that you would go to, right? The staff jobs are not as solid. You know, I have friends who, you know, once they get a staff job, they expect to be laid off in 9 to 18 months, you know, and it's sad, but there is an opportunity to say, hey, why don't you leave New York, go back to where you're from, and use a resource like Shoe Leather to tell those stories of your community, you know, in Ohio or in Indiana or in Kentucky for these national places and really make a difference in a different way.
So do I understand correctly that you are self-funding Shoe Leather at this point?
Yeah, to this point. It has been a real passion project. So that's been exciting thus far. We're starting the kind of machinations of becoming a nonprofit. So we're moving in that direction.
Do you envision getting to the point where you generate revenue so that it pays for itself? And how? How would you do that?
Absolutely. I mean, the next step is we're working on a bunch of collaborations to really not make Shoe Leather just a database. And that obviously will always be the foundation and will always be free, which is something that people ask a lot. But really building it out into a community for journalists from these non-media hub cities and you know, through a host of workshops and toolkits and things like that, really making it a place that can be a go-to resource for not only finding editor connections and local connections, but really building community.
To some of our listeners, I think a lot of people are really interested in how news and information is delivered to them and how reliable it can be, the sourcing and so forth. But why should this tool matter to listeners who have day jobs that are not in journalism, but who actually may rely on a reliable and solid source of news and information to get through their lives and their jobs?
Sure. I mean, there's absolutely nothing worse than seeing your community misrepresented on a national level. And I think that's something that everyone can relate to, that, you know, you don't want to pick up the Washington Post or the New York Times and feel like, you know, you're just that it's just a stereotype all over again there, you know, for the entire nation to read.
Oh, heaven knows if any place in this country knows that, Appalachia does.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so by using local reporters shoot through a service like Shoe Leather, you're really, you know, ensuring that that doesn't happen and that you have someone who's local, who goes to the same grocery store that you do, who goes to the same church that you do, you know, really telling these stories of your community for these national audiences.
Well, Sarah, good luck to you with this. This is a great, great endeavor.
Thank you.
Sarah Baird is founder of Shoe Leather, a web-based tool designed to promote better local reporting. We thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Coming up after the break, Jonathan Green joins us. He's the editor of the Richmond Register, a community paper that has been around in one form or another since 1809. And we'll also hear about the tight relationship between the presence of the local newspaper and the economic well-being of the community it serves. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the AllTech Ideas Conference. One is an incubator of innovation, a forum for future thinkers, and a platform for propelling forward the promise of a planet of plenty. Attendees view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives in order to make a difference in the world. Learn more about 119 in Lexington, May 19th through 21st, 2019, at one.alltech.com. Major support for WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson and their attorneys John Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church. Hicks & Funson is a Central Kentucky law firm proud to support NPR member station WEKU and fact-based reporting. More information at hfkylawyers.com.
If you were with us before the break, you heard Sarah Baird. She's the founder of the web-based journalism assignment tool Shoe Leather. Sarah was talking with us about connecting major city newspaper editors with local reporters and editors who know the lay of the land of their communities versus flying in journalists from these other larger markets who have little to no local perspective. Well, let's take a look at one of those community newspapers. The Richmond Register has been publishing for decades. No, make that centuries. Its history dates all the way back to 1809. The paper has changed hands many times over those years, and it has operated under a laundry list of mastheads, including the original Globe Register, followed by the Luminary, the Farmer's Chronicle, and the Weekly Messenger. There were more, but today the paper, now a property of Community Newspaper Holdings, Inc., is known as the Richmond Register, and its editor, Jonathan Green, joins us to talk about the community newspaper in general and an intriguing Richmond Register project in particular. Thanks for joining us, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
So if you would tell us a little bit about yourself, about your background in journalism.
Well, I've done a little bit of everything. I actually started out in sports talk radio, if you would believe that, and then somehow found my way into sports reporting at a sister paper of ours in Bluefield, West Virginia, and somehow now I'm in news, and I love every second of it. Never thought I would. You know, I was a sports guy growing up, read the paper every Saturday morning to see the sports scores and things like that, but I've really adjusted to the news side of things, and it's amazing what this community has as far as news and stories to tell.
And where do you call home? Where are you from originally?
I am from Weirton, West Virginia, which if you can find that on a map, is up near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It's in the northern panhandle of West Virginia. And my wife has some family over here, kind of split between Louisville and northern Kentucky. So this is the perfect spot to call home.
Well, yeah, Central Appalachia, we're all one big family.
Exactly.
So. What is the reach of the Register? What's your circulation like?
It's a little smaller now. We have about a readership of about 10,000. Circulation is obviously a little lower than that, but readership's a little higher. But a lot of it has adjusted to the digital age. You know, we have more than 2 million page views annually on our website, and you know, like all media, we're slowly and surely trying to adapt and reach new people in different ways.
Okay, and we're going to talk about those those different ways shortly. But small market newspapers, those with circulations under 50,000, make up the majority of papers in this country. What do these newspapers offer readers that they might not find in bigger city dailies?
Well, I think the best way to put it is to say what's in our paper. You know, we have everything from our city council meetings, which, you know, are showcasing, you know, what the taxpayer dollars are being spent on, to birthday announcements, you know, birth announcements, things like that. I mean, we run the whole thing, and we're part of the community. We're the, you know, source of record. But like I said, we have everything from birthday announcements and, you know, who won the local spelling bee to, you know, actual in-depth stories on what's happening in the county.
And we hear of issues faced by small market papers in recruiting and retaining young journalists, establishing relationships with the next generation of local news consumers in this digital age that we're in, and the big challenge, the wider challenge of overcoming general cynicism toward both the journalistic profession and mainstream media. Do you encounter any of these or any other challenges?
Oh, absolutely. And it's one of those that we just kind of go head on with. You know, we go out and talk to the local groups and just explain what we are. We're just a community paper. We don't, you know, really have a whole lot of opinion or bias one way or another. We're just reporting on what's happening in the community so you can stay informed. But, you know, there's a lot of challenges because we're a small staff. I have a total of 3 reporters, myself, and then 2 sports folks. So, you know, Madison County might seem like a small community to some, but there's a lot that happens here that, you know, sometimes it's a challenge to get there and cover everything.
I'd say a lot of community papers would consider that a pretty good staff.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We're very fortunate, and we've got a hardworking staff that enjoys getting out there and doing stories and telling stories.
So the Register was purchased in 1999, I believe, by CNHI, Community Newspaper Holdings Incorporated. The company owns a dozen, maybe 13 community papers across the Commonwealth. Has this provided any kind of beneficial economy of scale to you and to the other publications?
Absolutely. You know, whether it's sharing some business office duties amongst each other or just sharing content. You know, we have a collaboration amongst the sister papers here in the state, and it helps us, especially if a major political figure or story is happening, say in Ashland or Glasgow or Corbin, we can all share that with each other and be able to provide news that people really want to read that's exclusive to us and, you know, not just the, you know, something that everyone can get.
And I mentioned this digital age that we're in. How are you making use of social media and other of the emerging storytelling formats like podcasting or chat apps or even augmented virtual reality, those things?
I haven't gotten that far into virtual reality, but, you know, podcasts are something that we're slowly starting to, you know, develop because it's a new way to reach people. You know, everything's changing, and it's kind of an exciting time if you're up for change, maybe not if you're, you know, kind of used to just this the way it used to be. But, you know, social media is a big part, whether it's kind of just getting our stories out there or, you know, finding stories. To me, that's one of the best way to find some. We've got a story that is coming out this weekend that back in October, EKU police tweeted out a picture of one of their detectives who had been working graduation for several years, who's now going to be part of graduation. Huh. And so, you know, I was able to kind of work that into a story, and that'll be something that we get to put out this weekend. So you just never know where you're going to find sources anymore.
We're talking to Jonathan Green, editor of the Richmond Register, and I want to turn to something that you're doing that you've just announced. It's called Ask It Madison County. What's that?
It's a way that readers can kind of be part of the process of storytelling. They get to ask us questions that interest them or that they're curious about or want to know more about. You know, because obviously it's not like they can go out and easily find all this information. That's why we do what we do, and what we're good at is going out and investigating things. One of the biggest questions that we got asked for a long time is what's happening with Menards in Richmond. You know, there's just this big blank slate over there off the bypass. And that was one of the first questions when we debuted this series, and we were able to, you know, reach out to the city and to the company officials and find out what was going on. And that's what we hope to do with other things, and whether it's something small like that or something more deeper to investigate.
And how do you want readers to engage, and what should their expectations be?
It's just a way that they can ask a question. You know, we want them to ask questions because that way we know we're actually finding out information they want to know. You know, we kind of have an unofficial tagline of your stories, your community, and this is just another way that they can be part of that. And, you know, we can find out answers that they really want to know, because as much as I want to say we always know what the community wants, this is a great way for them to be part of it. You know, we'll even talk to them, ask them some more follow-up questions to see exactly what they're thinking or wanting to know. And I think it's going to be a great project to find out little bits of information that we may have overlooked or just stuff that, you know, has kind of gone unnoticed for a long time.
Do you want them to email, call, one of each? And if they email, if they happen to have some background information, I imagine that'd be helpful.
Oh, that'd be the best way. There's a couple different ways they can mail us, you know, kind of some information, because we need a little bit more in-depth to kind of get going. You know, the question's great, but, you know, we're always going to try to follow that up to make sure we're looking into what exactly they're asking. They can mail stuff to us at our address, 380 Big Hill Avenue in Richmond. They can email me at editor@richmondregister.com, or we have a form online at our website, richmondregister.com. If you look on the right side, you can see the Ask It Madison County logo. You click on that, fill out the form, and that comes directly to us.
Well, I'm looking forward to following this. I'm a subscriber. I get you every morning, so it'll be fun to see what comes from this.
Yeah, I am too. And like I said, we've already got some great questions that we're already starting to work on, and I can't wait to see kind of what we're able to do with this.
And we here at Eastern Standard would like to invite you, the Richmond Register, to bring these stories to Eastern Standard from time to time.
Absolutely.
Jonathan Green is editor of the Richmond Register, and we thank you for joining us, Jonathan.
Thank you.
As Steve Inskeep recently noted on Morning Edition, if you travel to a town with a good local newspaper, you can feel that. A good paper helps a town feel vibrant, open, accessible. In recent years, many towns have fewer papers, smaller papers, or no paper. And you feel that, too. And NPR Shankar Vedantam found a financial consequence.
In February 2009, Colorado's oldest newspaper, the Rocky Mountain News, shut down. Investigative reporter Laura Frank remembers that day. As she left the newsroom for the last time, Frank says she worried not just about her own financial future, but also about the work she was leaving behind.
I had all of these stacks of documents on my desk at the Rocky Mountain News, each representing some issue that I thought needed investigating.
One of those issues was electronics waste or e-waste. Frank was looking into a Colorado company that was allegedly sending e-waste to a village in China,
where people were dipping parts in acid and burning them over open flames to get little bits of gold and other metals. And they were exposing the village to dangerous levels of lead.
The federal government was also investigating these allegations.
So here you had an ongoing federal investigation into the role a Colorado company allegedly played in endangering kids in a foreign nation, and my newspaper was shutting down. We couldn't investigate, but the worst thing was no other local media had the capacity to investigate it either.
This, of course, is what happens when a newspaper shuts down. Some stories, especially the long and costly ones, simply don't get done. Where there once was reporting, there's now a void. And it was this void that piqued the interest of three finance professors, Dermot Murphy, Paul Gao, and Chang Li. They had a hunch that the loss of a newspaper might be bad for the financial health of a city or town. Specifically, they thought it might harm a municipality's ability to borrow money. So they investigated. Murphy says they started by looking at old newspaper almanacs.
So we combed through almanacs for the period 1996 to 2015 to figure out the newspaper closures over time.
It turns out that in that period, about 300 papers closed across the country.
And then we cross-referenced this information with government borrowing cost data.
They also looked at the borrowing power of cities and towns with thriving newspapers. When they were done crunching the data, they found there was a significant difference between places that had local newspapers and those that lost them. When a newspaper closed, the cost to borrow money for projects like schools and roads and hospitals, it went up.
In the long run, after a newspaper closes, the borrowing cost for governments increases by about 10 basis points or 0.1%.
You might be thinking here, that doesn't seem like a lot, but it adds up when loans are for huge amounts of money.
On average, a loan will be for $65 million in our sample.
With a 0.1% increase in a loan that size, taxpayers have to pay an extra $65,000 in interest. That's every year for the life of the loan, which could be 10 years or more. In addition, cities and towns usually have more than just one project in the works.
So if the government funds several projects in 1 year, then just multiply that by the number of projects, basically.
The bottom line? That little rate increase of 0.1% can cost taxpayers millions. So why are lenders charging more when towns don't have newspapers? Dermot Murphy and his colleagues had an idea.
So our intuition was that if a newspaper closes, then they are no longer performing a crucial watchdog role for keeping local governments in check.
And if local governments are not being kept in check,
then they are more likely to engage in bad behavior and just generally be more inefficient.
And that makes it riskier to lend money to that city or town.
And so when a lender is more nervous about lending to an inefficient government, then they're going to have to ask for a higher interest rate on the money they're lending to compensate for that risk.
And of course, there's an irony here. People who cancel their newspaper subscriptions to save money will be among the taxpayers who bear the cost of higher interest rates.
It's an interesting trade-off, really. If the local newspaper is no longer around, then the local news consumer no longer is paying for that newspaper. So I suppose they save dollars in that sense. But in the other sense, borrowing costs go up for the local governments, and they, as a taxpayer, are ultimately going to be footing that bill. So we think that the net cost is definitely higher.
Former Rocky Mountain News reporter Laura Frank is well aware of the value of investigative reporting to a community. So after the Rocky shut down, she came up with a new project to keep investigative journalism alive. She used money from a fellowship to start a nonprofit. She called it iNews.
And the I stood for investigative. And the idea was that we would do investigative stories and share them with other newsrooms. And that's what we did.
And one of the first stories that Frank reopened was that one about e-waste. Not only did Frank's team confirm that electronics waste from Colorado was being illegally exported and smelted abroad, they discovered something else.
We found that some of the same kinds of dangerous practices that were happening in China and Hong Kong, it was happening right here in Colorado on a much smaller scale, but completely under the radar of state regulators.
Eventually, Frank's team produced a hard-hitting report. It was widely picked up by other newspapers and TV stations. It was a victory for great journalism. But Frank says the 2 years it took to get the work published was simply too long.
So how many children were exposed and wound up with high levels of lead in their blood while we were trying to figure out a way to get the story out?
And then Frank says there are all the other stories no one is even aware of. They simply remain untold.
It's the unknown unknown that is also very worrisome to me.
Those unknown unknowns, they can end up costing us the most. Shankar Vedantam, NPR News.
On next week's edition of Eastern Standard, what's the backstory on bringing Top Chef to Kentucky? We'll hear from the person who made it happen, Kentucky Tourism Commissioner Kristen Branscombe. Lexington fashion designer Sarita Begley shares her childhood in the sweatshops of Honduras and why she blends art and activism.
My activism kind of keeps my art going. I don't think that I will be doing this work as much or even doing it at all if it wasn't for my passion to educate the public about the reality of the fashion industry beyond the magazines and the runway shows.
And speaking of art, we'll introduce a new content partner for Eastern Standard, Undermain, the Lexington-based online cultural affairs magazine. First up, we'll get you acquainted with Matt Collinsworth, the new interim director of the Lexington Art League, and his plans to support the region's visual artists.
We're also going to draw new artists to the community. We're going to make the culture of the city more vibrant, as well as making the economy more vibrant.
These stories and much more on next week's edition of Eastern Standard. That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of ONE, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our chief production engineer and editor. Eastern Standard's growing list of content partners includes WEKU News, the Ohio Valley Resource, the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, Kentucky Humanities, the Kentucky Historical Society, the Lexington Herald Leader, the Richmond Register, Undermain, the EKU Chautauqua Lecture Series, and the Transylvania University Creative Intelligence Lecture Series. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.